Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington, and I'm catching up with Austin Wintry, and you just keep churning out these amazing, amazing soundtracks, and it's so much fun to have a chance to check back in and see what you've been up to lately.
Well, that's very kind of you. I'm very lucky that, especially as we'll get into on projects that are so different from each other, that was always my goal from the beginning of my career, is like I was always afraid of the idea of just kind of going in circles over and over again. I think probably on the basis that I don't have the depth of creativity to just endlessly reinvent myself or something like that. And so when projects naturally kind of force that on you, lest you be in breach of contract, it's convenient and it's thrilling. So yeah, I'm thrilled to talk to you as always, and especially happy with the kind of unexpected collision of these two otherwise radically unrelated projects.
Yeah, it's been interesting to listen to them side by side because they are really different. Absolver has such a different feel to Tooth and Tail, and yet listening to them like one track from one and one track to another, there are similarities a little bit in the instrumentation and a little bit in the feel. So it's been kind of a neat way of comparing and contrasting them. And I think Absolver especially is neat because it's a great example of what happens when you're not expecting anything. Because it sounds like Slow Clap, the studio, kind of reached out to you with the idea of doing the music for their game.
Yeah, the creative director there, Pierre, they're all, it's worth mentioning that Slow Clap is a brand new studio. This is their first game. They're all formerly Ubisoft employees based out of Paris. And they started their own independent company. And they had crossed paths at some point, I think just socially, with members of the Banner Saga team. And my name, I guess, came up and got recommended in there somewhere. And so I just get this call out of nowhere from this guy, Pierre, who says, I want to show you this game. And we ended up having this really long Skype. It just got along so well, so quickly. And I was really intrigued by the game they were making because he kind of off the cuff said this expression while we were talking, which has become a kind of mantra since then, that the game is about, quote, friendship through combat. And what he meant by that was the idea that it's a fighting game in the quasi tradition of, you know, Tekken or Mortal Kombat or something, except it's a 3D game and it has, you know, some vaguely RPG elements to it. But it's really an online melee combat game, and it's very stripped down in its essence to really being about the elegance of martial arts. And it's not just a button smasher, brute force kind of thing, but it's very much about learning discipline and restraint and the things that go into legitimate martial arts. And then the RPG tinges, it's really not an RPG, but the kind of tinges of that come in with the way you build these combinations, and you can change your armor and get some basic weaponry and things like that. But all of that is kind of gameplay mechanics, technicalities. What really struck me was that it was about meeting people in the world online or playing with your friends or whatever and fighting in order to make each other better. It's not about I'm going to dominate you and show you how ass-kicking I am. It's about us learning from each other. And in fact, that's the only way to learn moves in the game, is to fight someone who has those moves. And so you can't just go and kind of do random quests that level you up or something like that. You actually have to tango with people. And I use that word because there was a lot of discussion of the idea of it feeling kind of dance-like, which is the obvious point of overlap it has with Tooth and Tail, but we'll get to that later, I guess. But the point of that first conversation with Pierre was that this was something where they wanted that empathy and that spirit of camaraderie through, you know, the whole friendship through combat idea to really come through. And also this overt goal to avoid the kind of martial arts genre clichés of the taiko ensemble and the you know, kind of Japanese or otherwise Asian instrumentation, that kind of thing. It was like, let's just explore and see what we can cook up.
It's so interesting because the feel of the game, what it really reminded me of is the quietness and sort of the stillness and emptiness of like Shadow of the Colossus and Ico and The Last Guardian. It is a very old world that you get put into, and there are shrines and these other people, and yet there's a quietness to it, and it's very restrained. So how many iterations, or how did you go about finally defining what the palette was going to be for the music?
Well, that the palette itself was by far the most iterative part of the process. We also did iterate quite a lot on the technical side of exactly how the music behaves in the game, because that was, you know, an endless, seemingly endless series of experiments as well. And I say that with a smile on my face. Endless makes it sound like I'm complaining, but it was... The game, because of the nature of the mechanics, lent itself to a variety of approaches, and so we experimented quite a lot with that and just trying to make it feel really tight and seamless. But as for the palette, honestly, it was just almost like a trial and error kind of, let's just try this, let's try that. Sometimes I have a very specific kind of intellectualized reason why something seems like it just... It has to be that way. You know, like on Abzu, the use of all the harps was one of those things that it felt like it captured that flurry of energy that comes from a kind of lush coral reef environment where you have a million little points of movement in the form of, you know, tens of thousands of fish. And yet, taken from a wide view, it's kind of a static object that just is sort of flickering. And to me, that, you know, big wall of harps felt similar. And I wasn't trying to make like this obvious literal analogy, but it just felt compatible in a way that seemed right. And there was something of an intellectual justification for it, or I don't know how intellectual, but there was something of a justification one way or the other. In this case, it was really just like, what if we tried this? What if we tried that? What if we tried this? And we knew more what we wanted to avoid more than what we wanted to do. I mean, one of the first trailers, actually the first trailer, they had hired another composer and kind of, I think he was more of a DJ type of guy to score the trailer. And it was very effective and very much kind of in the vein of trailer music. And it was like, okay, we like the hard-hitting impact of this, but we, you know, we can set aside a lot of those trappings. And then they cut this reel, I remember, at one point internally that was never shown. It was just a kind of thing for us all to look at and discuss. And they had put... I'm trying to remember now what it was. It was something... I think it was from one of Rachmaninoff's symphonies. It was definitely Rachmaninoff, but I can't remember now if it was one of the concerti. No, it was definitely not one of the concerti. But it might have been like Isle of the Dead or one of the symphonies. But it was a very kind of... typically Rachmaninoff, very, you know, late romantic, brooding, orchestral sort of piece. It wasn't a big, loud, fanfarish kind of thing. If it wasn't Isle of the Dead, at least it felt like that. But either way, it was one of those where they said, we love the tone of this, but it for sure answers the question that we do not want something orchestral. And just because it felt expected, it felt ordinary, it felt common. And I said, okay, great, let's just keep exploring. And so I just started trying things at random, basically, and seeing how it felt. Oh, actually, there's one other thing. I love when musicians I work with, they often will inspire me based on things that I know that they do well or things that I know they enjoy doing. And two things happened simultaneously early in the process of this score that also helped lead part of the direction, which was a guitarist that I work with on virtually every score I do named Tom Strahler, and he's also extensively featured on Tooth and Tail. Once a month or every few weeks, he buys something new that he plays and wants me to know that it's available if I want to write for it. And, you know, he'll be like, oh, I just got this new, you know, six-string mandocello that's got this cool thing where I can retune the bottom string and or whatever. He always has some new shenanigan he's up to. And they're always just so delicious and something I'm eager to write for. And so he had bought this new interesting sort of six-string electric bass that had this fantastic sound, and he also had bought this guitar that he was tuning the strings to be unisons so he could do these rapid kind of almost drones, and then he would pitch bend one of the strings so that it's kind of like a single pitched drone that then divides itself like cells dividing into this dissonant interval. He sent me all these kind of experiments of him playing like that. And I was like, oh man, electric bass could be an interesting color for this score because it's so inorganic to the rawness of the world, but it's very organic to the intensity of the gameplay. And so I was really kind of salivating at the idea of featuring electric bass rather prominently in the score. And then around that same time, I played the remake of Doom. And Mick Gordon's score just completely blew my mind. It was such beautifully executed kind of thrashing carnage and a very metal-esque score. And I thought, okay, I can't avoid the electric bass. It is a must. So that led me down a path of featuring a lot of very guitar-like instruments, but then very quickly went in a direction of fusing a lot of acoustic and electric elements where, for example, the electric bass combined with like a dobro or banjo. And one thing Tom loves to do also is we always come up with weird ways to play these instruments. And something that we did on a movie earlier this year that I said that I only used on a single cue in that film for like 15 seconds, but I thought this has to be explored more, was him playing his banjo with a bottle cap, like a Coke bottle cap, and it has this wonderful kind of sort of quality to the way it attacks because of all the little ridges on the side of the bottle cap. And so that's featured constantly in Absolver, is banjo being played with a bottle cap, and then I do all kinds of weird processing to it and things like that as well. it's funny how Doom was not a direct musical inspiration, but it's a powerful indirect one. And I don't know that it would have tipped me over the edge to feature electric bass as much as I did if I hadn't played that score and just fallen in love with it so much. But there you have it.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating because I was trying to identify what those instruments are. I mean, it sounded a little bit like there was a cymbalom in there and a prepared piano, and I could totally hear, you know, the kind of shreddy, amazing sound that Mick got for Doom, and all mixed together. It's just it's visceral, and yet it doesn't overpower the game, and it fits so well with the combat sequences, but then also the quietness of the landscape. And what was so interesting was, as I mentioned, listening to this plus Tooth and Tail, because you did use a lot of the same musicians. You just use them in different ways for Tooth and Tail, and you kind of touched on the idea of the dance concept. You know, skirmishes are kind of like tangos, which is such a cool way to think about them.
Well, it's funny. This, ever since Assassin's Creed Syndicate, I've been kind of obsessed with the idea of making combat feel dance-like. I mean, because on that one, we hit on the notion explicitly that combat would be done with waltzes. And then, yeah, like 3 years ago when Andy Schatz and I first started talking about Tooth and Tail, it had a different name back then, but when we first started talking about it, it was, he said, I want to make a game where teenage boys enjoy dancing together. And that was this kind of metaphor for the idea that real-time strategy at its most interesting and most elegant should feel more like a dance and less like just kind of hurling armies at each other. Because he really wanted to distill the core ideas of the real-time strategy genre to something very approachable. Because we all agree that games like Warcraft 3 and Starcraft 1 and 2, etc., are spectacular games if you like real-time strategy. But they're very intimidating if you're not already kind of deep into that world. And especially if you want to play online, the field of competition is so outrageous. It would be like, hey, I'm interested in cycling. I'm going to go try the Tour de France. And so Andy said, I want to make something that let anybody could play. It's, you know, it's kind of the similar idea that Journey had, where we wanted to make a game that felt approachable to people that have never picked up a controller in their life. And the real-time strategy genre is one that has a, you know, obviously it has a cousin in the form of turn-based strategy that has enjoyed a very long and rich history in the tabletop gaming world. And so there's a lot of people that would play, you know, Risk or Stratego and would be intimidated by a game like StarCraft but could potentially really enjoy real-time strategy in a video game otherwise. And so Andy's saying, like, how can I make a game that would appeal to people like that but also have the depth to appeal to the hardcore StarCraft and whatnot players as well. And so he spent years refining the gameplay, but and one of the things we always talked about in tandem with that was, how do we make this feel, it should be fun, and dancing in this case is meant to feel fun, whereas Absolver, the dance is more about the kind of elegance of it. You know, it's like ballet. I think of Absolver as more like ballet or contemporary dance, as opposed to Tooth and Tail, which is like folk dance. It's like a group of peasants in a barn just enjoying themselves kind of thing, like you would see in a scene from Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones or something like that. Thank you. in many respects, from a narrative standpoint, in many ways, Tooth and Tail is quite a lot darker than Absolver, because it's essentially about this vicious war amongst animals and a kind of Animal Farm style of brutality, where the winner gets to be the one who decides, who gets to eat the rest. You know, it's like the victors shall feast is one of the kind of little mantras or like slogans or something of the game. It's all these animals fighting for dominance, such that those who lose will die on a barbecue. And so we're taking a kind of dark thing and making it a bit silly almost. And Absolver, we're taking something and trying to inject it with maximum elegance. But it always comes back to this notion of dancing and of energy that's not just the kind of chugging 16th notes that you hear pervasively in kind of action music, but it's actually saying, okay, what if we give it a snappiness to it? You know, we give it a bit of a wink and a nod almost.
Yeah, well, and it's neat too, because that initial theme, the Food of Beasts, the Tripod did, which is just brilliant, that melody keeps turning up in a lot of the different cues. And so it must have been fun to come up with all these different versions of it.
Well, and it's interesting because initially I wrote that theme, which has two main components to it. There's like the fight song. I was picturing like guys in a bar drinking and singing, like raising their glasses. So it starts off with this very simple kind of fight song. You know, like I was trying to think of something that could be so utterly simple, like Queen's, you know, We Will Rock You kind of thing. Like it's just this like very basic rhythmic, just chun chun chun. So this little motif, this bum bottom bottom, just over and over, that simple little thing. And then the other aspect to it is, because of the quasi Animal Farm quality to it, I thought it would be cute to give the thing a Russian tinge. And so that little bum bottom bottom thing evolves into this, it's meant to very much feel like a Russian sort of folk song. And so the idea was, you know, that's the main theme of the score, and now I have to figure out how to make it dance. I was working with Tripod on our show, because this was years ago, you know, that they were in Los Angeles to work on our show called This Gaming Life, which we previously had done in Adelaide and in Melbourne. And we were still writing that show. And so they were in town, and I just said, hey, can you guys do like drunken Russian tavern singing for me? And I wrote out some harmonies, and they sang it, and we multi-tracked it. And they waved around and went way off mic and did all this stuff that makes it sound pretty authentically like a drunk choir. Because I just happened to have it on my screen when they walked into the studio. And I said, oh, this could be fun. And then I put it away and circled back to it, you know, like a week later. And so, all right, I forgot that Tripod's in here. And then I ended up going back to them like 2 years later to record more material that you can also hear on the album. There's all these little stingers that you hear sung in our fake Russian language that was developed by the sound designer Kevin Ragamy. There's a whole entire language in the game that we affectionately were calling its kind of nickname is Rushlish, in honor of the Simlish language from The Sims, that sort of sounds vaguely like a language, but it's not. In our case, it actually is a language where all these words and even lyrics were written in English, and then Kevin translated them and then created these pronunciation guides, and it's meant to be very Slavic. But the irony is, later, as the game developed, it became clear that, you know, there's these four commanders, which my sort of names for them in my files were the military, the commoners, the aristocrats, and the clergy. Now they have more refined names of, you know, the common folk, the long coats, the civilized, and the KSR, which is like, you know, sort of like saying
the Red Army,
the KGB. Yeah, exactly. And they're the different factions of this world, you know, the kind of clerical, old-fashioned class, the wealthy, you know, like Lannisters, and then the common folk, led by Hopper, who's missing her arm because she cut it off in order to feed her people, all that kind of thing. And so I started to realize, you know, the main theme, as much as I was satisfied with where it ended up, it's kind of characterizing the world overall, but all of your gameplay comes through the lens of playing as one of these factions. And the thing is, unlike games like StarCraft, choosing your faction does not change like your strategy or your tactics at all, because your units at your disposal are identical. It just changes the color that they are, basically. Like, the aristocrats are blue, and the commoners are kind of red, and that sort of thing. It's just a way to kind of reskin your army. But the game is all about building decks of units that you are playing almost like a game of poker against your opponent, where you're trying to build these robust decks that give you interesting choices you can make, and also anticipate choices of your opponent. And so if there's, say, there's 24 or so different types of units in the game, you can only choose 6 at a time, but your opponent has at their disposal all the same options. And so as a result, one of the biggest ways to differentiate the factions is the music that plays based on your choice. So it's one of those things where it's almost like we're reskinning the game musically based on which character you're choosing to lead your army. So if I choose the KSR, all these brassy waltzes will be my underscore. And my opponent fighting with me, say they choose Belafid, the aristocrat, they'll be hearing string orchestra with bassoon solo tarantellas as their score. But we may have chosen identical units and be fighting with very similar strategies. So the biggest differentiation in the game ends up being actually the score. The irony being that the main theme ends up essentially being completely useless because I said I want them to be so stylized that they actually have their own themes that are developed through the choice of faction. So I wrote four sort of new sub-main themes for each faction, and then the main theme after that just became this thing I kind of referenced subtly thereafter. So it essentially lives in the trailer and the main theme, and that's about it. I've never had a score like that. I tend to be very obsessed with the idea that you write your theme very carefully and so that you can leverage it and milk it for all it's worth. You know, like Journey is kind of an obvious example of that, where I'm not a fan of just throwing more themes constantly at a score because it feels lazy. It feels like, oh, I don't know how to develop my theme to account for this new character or this new scenario or this new whatever. But in this case, it actually really would have run against what the game was trying to do. And so it's as a result, it's one of the most melodic scores I've probably ever written because it's just like every 5 seconds there's a new theme.
And, you know, there's all these different areas where the battles take place. There's the Snickery and the kitchen and all of these places. And so did you give them their own musical identity too, or is it just solely based on the factions and the characters?
Yeah, it's 100% factions because those track titles are derived from the single-player campaign, which was actually written and executed after the score for the game was essentially completely finished. It was originally planned as a multiplayer-only game, and so the score was conceived of purely for the kind of dynamic unpredictability of the multiplayer kind of environment. And as Andy said, actually, I want to add a single player, and he wrote this. He created, and there's another writer named Alex Kane who helped develop a rather amazing single player campaign. I mean, for something that was added relatively late in the process, it's really very good. But we had to essentially, I had already recorded the orchestra and all this stuff, so the score was kind of locked, and I had to, in a way, reverse engineer the multiplayer score to fit the single player campaign. And so the track titles are a little deceptive in that way. I just loved, those are the names of the missions in the single player campaign, and I loved their titles so much. They were so spectacular and kind of evocative that I had to steal them. But in reality, the music was not written for those missions at all. It's kind of a cheat, I fully confess. And similarly, all the music edits that you hear on the album, where you'll hear like the tango of the clergy get smashed up against the waltz of the military, none of that's remotely possible ever in game because you can't change commander in the middle of a mission. So you would never hear that. But I said, you know, as my norm, I'm listening to an album. I'm not playing the game. The music needs to be reflective of the experience that I'm actually having, which is listening to a linear piece of music. And so for the album, everything gets completely and totally reconceived, and, you know, remixes and all that end up being necessary for it to feel not boring, basically. We'll be right back. Which, who knows if I succeeded, but it's a lot of work.
Well, yeah, I'm sure it is. And one of the things that I've really appreciated about the way you create the soundtracks that go with the games is that they are really special experiences. It's almost like getting DLC from a game because you can enjoy them away from the console or the screen. And I know you put a really, really lot of thought into creating a different experience or kind of an augmented experience with the music, and especially with these two, with Absolver. You got to collaborate with RZA for one of the tracks, and I'd love to know how that came about.
That was a really unexpected, genuine pleasure. What happened was, the score to Absolver is like 2 hours and 10 minutes worth of music or something like that. It's a fair amount of score. And I was finishing the writing, and I still had just a few cues, but significant cues left with about a month to go on the project. And Pierre, the creative director, just calls me out of the blue and goes, I have an opportunity to float your way that I think you're going to be interested in. So, you know, it's like eyebrows ascend. And he said, so we just got in touch with, pretty much out of nowhere, the Wu-Tang Clan's founder and a kind of genuine legend of hip-hop, RZA, who is apparently, and I had not known this, a massive sort of walking encyclopedia of martial arts films, particularly. He's also a practitioner of martial arts, but he's a, you know, like a genuine expert on the genre in both gaming and in film. He's a big nerdy gamer too, as it turns out. And you know, he collects games. He has hundreds of box title games, and obviously he's a huge fan of fighting games, of martial arts games as well. Kind of combines several of his parallel interests. And so his fans had heard about Absolver after it was announced at E3 last year and just started, like, tweeting at him and writing on Facebook and whatnot, hey, you should check out this game. And so somewhere along the way, he just said, oh, it looks awesome. I'd love to buy that. I think it looks fun. I want to play it. And somehow that led to him getting in touch with the developers, and he more or less just said, hey, if you have a role for me, I'd be thrilled to be part of it. And they said, well, you know, we already have a composer and we're almost done with the game, but let's see what we can do. So they just called me and said, do you want to work with him? I said, why not? That's because I have no idea what that will yield. And that's why it's exciting. I as a composer, I'm always deathly afraid of just endlessly repeating myself. And when you collaborate with others, it pretty much instantaneously guarantees that won't happen. Because you've injected this X factor into the equation that you can't predict, you can't control. It's coming from a different background, a different sensibility, especially someone like him. It's not like a fellow classically trained orchestral kind of composer like me. Even that would yield potentially unique results. You know, like if Bear McCreary were to want to co-write something, you know, we have a lot of overlap in our histories. But of course, we would bring something to each other that we couldn't synthesize on our own. But someone like RZA, it's exponentially far more so. And so I said, well, let's get connected and see if we gel. And he and I jumped on the phone. And I said, man, I love the idea of us working together. And as it turns out, in the single player, you know, narrative campaign of the game, there's this final boss named Rizrin that you have a kind of extended multi phase final battle with, and I haven't written that music yet. And so what do you think of the idea of co-writing kind of the, not just some random cue, but literally the grand finale? It's totally coincidental that I haven't done that yet, but it's kind of a good one for us to tackle, because it sort of lets us get away with the most musical adventurousness. And it's, you know, inevitably kind of a featured moment with someone like him. It puts to good use all he's able to bring to the table, that it not be some more subtle kind of accompanimental cue for one of the quieter moments of the game. And he was totally into that. And I said, well, here's the thing. Let me send you some of the music that I've already written for the game to give you a sense of it and see if you actually like it, because we've spent over a year trying to figure out how to kind of defy genre conventions. And as a result, I have no idea what genre I'm even writing. I literally have no idea what to call it. And it might be too weird. You might think it's not your thing. And I want to give you the right to say that before we've wasted any time, basically. And he said, awesome, I'll send you what I wrote also. And I said, what? This was our first phone call. And he said, yeah, I've just been excited about this idea. So I just went into the studio and wrote a bunch of stuff. And it's all good if you don't like any of it, but just see what you think. I was like, you already started working? And he said, well, yeah, I mean, the game looks awesome, man. I thought, my God, this guy is for real. I mean, and he sent me, and it was like 4 minutes of music. I mean, it was a non-trivial. It wasn't just some little thing. It was all, you know, demos, mock-ups. It wasn't like his final production, but it was very clear and detailed and thorough. And the thing that was also really surprising to me was it was completely orchestral. It was, because he had no idea that we had, you know, intentionally avoided that. And it was like orchestral, almost like in a Morricone kind of spaghetti Western way. And I thought, ooh, I like the idea of bringing a kind of Western flavor. There's three boss battles in the game, and each one has its own kind of stylized quality. You know, the first one is a guy named Kuritz, inspired by the character from the Heart of Darkness. And so there's kind of a deranged madness to this character, and so the music is as well. And then the second boss is actually a pair of siblings named Kilnor and Kargal. And so for that one, I wanted something very kind of slinky and deceptive. And I don't know what I would label it genre-wise, but it's also kind of a featured electric bass thing. That was one of the things I was working on when I decided that was my new obsession with this score. And so I thought for the third one, what if it's got a kind of a Western feel? It's just as arbitrary a choice as all the others I'm making, but it's compatible with all these others. Because what I had said to Pierre was, it's important that if I collaborate with RZA, when we reach the culminating moment of the narrative, I don't want it to suddenly shift gears and feel like we're in a totally different score. It's very important to me that I want to bring an X factor in the form of his collaboration, but it has to be cohesive to the rest of the score, or otherwise we're shooting ourselves in the foot. We're doing something because we think it'll make headlines and not because it's creatively defensible. And I won't do that. And he completely agreed, of course. He said, it's not, we're only interested because RZA seems passionate, not because his name is RZA and because people might want to write about that. And I said, good, then we're totally on the same page. And so I said to him, look, there's things in this that are very cool, and I love the kind of Western quality, but we've actually totally avoided orchestral music. And I said, so why don't you listen to the stuff I'm going to send you and see what else it inspires? He said, oh, no worries, man, not at all. And so then he sent me several more, like another 7 or 8 minutes of stuff that was much more kind of weird and experimental. And he also dug out some kind of retro synths and some old-fashioned keyboards that have him playing this stuff, and it's all wild-timed and no click track. And so there was the word he used for it was, it was something intentionally awkward, and but he wanted something that felt a little tilted because he heard what I was doing and realized, oh, we could be a bit weird with this. And so then I took an actual melody from his orchestral Western thing and reconceived it within all my weird guitars and dobro and electric bass, and added in a bunch of my own material. And then I also stripped out elements from his subsequent pieces, especially some of the rhythmic elements, but also he had this one really weird dissonant arpeggiated figure that I ended up deeply, I used his literal performance of it, and then I did my own variations of it. And so by the end, what you're hearing is a pretty legitimate 50-50 split, where I'm playing with ideas of his, he wrote ideas inspired by things I said to him, and then I'm also merging it in both a material way and in a literal stems audio kind of way with what he did. And so it's a real genetic hybrid that it's not just some token like, oh, I used his three-note melody, but it's otherwise all me. It really is co-written.
Thank you.
yes, and the guy is awesome. He had no ego whatsoever. Anytime I said, do you mind if I get rid of this, or I change that, or I pitch this up, or I blah, blah, blah. He's like, do it, man, do it. Just have fun. Just play with it. Send me what you're thinking, and maybe I can bounce things off of that and whatever. And the whole thing took place within like a two-week period because we were so close to finish. But we got it done, and I'm really happy with it. It was totally unlike anything I've ever done, of course. And now he and I are trying to figure out, okay, what are we going to do together next? This was great.
That's so cool. And because when I was listening to it, it's different, but it's not different in a strange way. And it doesn't sound like it doesn't belong there. I mean, it makes absolutely perfect sense that it would be music for the final boss, because you know, there's this buildup for things getting more and more difficult and things ramping up. And so it's just so cool to have that in there. It's really it just adds so much to the whole soundtrack. So that is super cool.
Well, I appreciate it. It was really fun. I mean, it was one of those things that I just did not see coming at all, and really, really resonated with. It was just too much fun.
Yeah, because I mean, you don't normally collaborate much with anybody. I know you did with Jason or The Order. But other than that, I mean, you tend to just kind of go your own way with the soundtracks. So,
yeah, I don't have any recurring kind of co-writers other than Tripod, where we write songs together quite a lot, and because they'll have musical ideas and then also spectacular lyrical ideas, and we've gotten into a really good place. We've co-written quite a lot of material at this point, and I just absolutely adore working with them. And there's a couple other songwriters with whom I've done that as well. But in general, you're right. I don't really tend to co-write with people. I don't seek it out much, but when it presents itself as a possibility, I almost always embrace it for all the reasons I said before. It just lets me step outside of myself. The situation with Jason on The Order was obviously highly atypical, since both he and I don't really work in pairs. I mean, he and I are similar in everything that I'm saying right now. But yeah, you're right. It's just one of those things that it usually doesn't make sense, because we're trying to usually make something that's, you know, we're aspiring to something that's unique. And if it's not built from the ground up with another person, the uniqueness, it seems like, is going to get drained away, because that other person is going to, by necessity, by default, they're going to be coming from outside of your vision. And so it's potentially creating a new, interesting vision, but that's one where I say I'd rather build that with them from the beginning, so that the meeting point of the two aesthetics is the unique vision, as opposed to me trying to craft something really specific and then someone else having to kind of learn what that is and catch up. It's just, it feels weird. It's one of those things that just never seems to really work.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's one of those. I kind of like the lone wolf approach.
Cat that walks alone.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's been characteristic of the overwhelming majority of composers throughout history.
For sure. I mean, as far as I know, you know, Beethoven didn't collaborate with anybody. The great songwriting duos, but that's another animal altogether. And
exactly. I will say, though, the one exception, like the one loophole that's sort of worth mentioning, or the sort of loophole that is worth mentioning, is the collaboration I have with musicians, the actual recording musicians. Yeah, that's definitely a major part of it. I work in a very detailed way, and there's almost never anything even remotely approaching improvising, for example, in my work. I mean, I get real specific on bowings and articulations and all the rest of it, but at the same time, I like to leave space for the musicians to be able to bring their personality to it, so that it's the resulting recording is something that only that person could have made. And to me, Journey is probably my favorite example of this, because it's so centric around Tina Guo's cello solos. But Absolver, actually, you know, the only other musician that I feature quite a lot, other than Tom, the guitarist, is Kristen Nagus, the oboist slash every other woodwind.
Yeah, she's kind of like a Swiss Army knife of.
she very much is, and so I said to her, I want to feature some interesting winds on the score, and I'm thinking probably Bansuri because it has a beautiful color, but it's also relatively neutral. I don't want a classical kind of like oboe, for example, sound on the score. I want something that feels a little bit more broadly otherworldly. And Bansuri, even though it's, you know, it's obviously a very ethnically specific instrument, like all instruments are, its color can easily be blended with other colors to become something kind of otherworldly. But then I said to her, you know, what if we started trying to double that, though, with other instruments you have? And I'm just curious what you would double it with. And I remember she sent me one where it was like a penny whistle, an octave higher than the Bansuri part. And I said, ooh, this is interesting. And I EQ'd it heavily and, like, compressed it, put a lot of reverb. So the penny whistle almost sounds like it's the reverb of the Bansuri. You don't really hear it on its own. It becomes this additive color. And then I see in the folder, you know, she was recording these in her home studio in Florida. And so she would send me a bunch of files at a time, and I opened up. And one of them, the file name was like, you know, bar 7 of whatever cue, English horn, so sue me, or something like that. Like, because I had specifically said I don't want anything kind of traditional Western orchestral. But she had decided she wanted to record English horn anyway. You know, she's an oboist, so she can't resist. And the blend of the Bansuri and this whistle and the English horn was like the magic sauce. And I had her do every single cue from that point forward that way. And I would never have thought to try that because the English horn added this body to the sound behind the Bansuri. And then the whistle, of course, like I said, became this kind of halo, the shimmer, almost like the reverb. And so virtually every time you hear her playing, you're actually hearing at least three of her playing in this way where I meticulously make this blend. And I would never have thought of that on my own. That was 100% her contribution, and that's a perfect example of when a musician brings something that becomes part of the identity, and it's not really changing the writing, and yet it is in a tactile and meaningful way, and I love that. I absolutely love that.
Yeah, no, it's neat. It's so cool when that happens. And then Sandy Cameron, too, the violinist that you've worked with a lot with Assassin's Creed Syndicate and Deformers and so many other games. She just has such incredible style and presence, and just the
definitely the
guts that she plays with is really amazing.
Yeah, the tangos on Tooth and Tail are all about Sandy, and the idea with those was originally I said, what if since it's for the clergy faction, I said, what if it's a tango but entirely executed on pipe organ, just to be silly, and I started playing around with that. But then it was like it wasn't quite coming off how I was hoping. It was one of those ideas that sounds more interesting on paper than it did in execution, at least the way I was doing it. So I said, well, okay, what if it's pipe organ with a kind of classic, almost Piazzolla sort of violin solo? And so I, of course, it just gives me any excuse to call Sandy back. We were still in the midst of working on Deformers in the middle of that. And so she was kind of having to ping pong between those two while we were working. And yeah, it's the same thing. You know, she would play the line and I would say, what if you gave it just a little, as you drove to the downbeat of bar five, what if the bow migrated towards the bridge so it got raspy and sul ponticello-esque by the time we reached the downbeat in a kind of migratory sort of way? And she would say, yeah, but what if I did it like this and would bow it, you know, a little differently, and then this nasty kind of wonderful color would come out that, again, I wouldn't have thought to ask for. In some cases, she would bow things in ways that I wouldn't even know how to ask for, because it's just so violinistic in such an esoteric way that as a non-violinist, I don't even know that I would have known it could do that. And she kept bringing, as she always does, those kinds of little details. And so, yeah, she's the tooth and tail bits with her. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's another just absolutely perfect example of a soloist that I cast for a reason, because I know they're going to elevate the whole thing immensely, that it will be something that I could never have been without them.
And it's so cool because now you've got this merry band of musicians, kind of, you know, sort of like a repertory theater, like, you know, Christopher Guest.
Ah, that's
all
great.
The same people are in them, they're playing different characters, and that's kind of how your soundtracks seem to be now. And so, does that relationship that you've got now, going, you know, for years in some cases, does that become a kind of a shorthand so they know right away kind of what you're thinking?
Oh, definitely. I mean, Tina Guo and I have worked together for a decade, and she and I, we just worked together, you know, yet again on a film a couple months ago, and it was, you know, it's like our 5 millionth collaboration, and it's absolutely the shorthand and the comfort, the speed with which you're able to work, because it's like dating. The first date, even at its best, is bound to be a little awkward. And we're so far past that phase. And so you're absolutely right. To me, I like to make the musicians in my life a blend of people like Tina or Sandy or Kristen that I've worked with many, many times. And then also a regular influx of new people that, kind of like the situation with RZA, they bring something I can't predict and therefore need and can't live without. So I'm always trying to meet new folks as well. But yeah, I love your sort of theater, your sort of repertory company Now, I've never thought of it that way, but that's a spectacular comparison to draw, because that is absolutely spot on. I mean, that's a very apt analogy. I love that.
Well, it's been fun hearing them in different roles with the different soundtracks, too, because each one of the soundtracks is different and it serves a different purpose and has a different feeling. You know, they bring something else, too. So, I mean, Kristen doesn't sound the same in Abzu as she does in Tooth and Tail. And so,
no, not at all. I mean, and that's all by design. You know, it's like recording oboe on Abzu. I would say to her, you know, this is pure. This is spiritual. This is, you know, like that. There's that wonderful English horn solo that every English hornist has to know for their auditions by Sibelius, the Swan of Tuonela. And I said, you know, think like that on a game like Abzu, but on a game like Tooth and Tail, you know, I said, don't play in time with the other instruments. You're a folk musician playing an improvised. It's not improvised, but it should feel like an improvised kind of tavern performance. Because on Tooth and Tail, Kristen plays like penny whistle and things like that. And then it's wholly all together again. It's to be very introspective and very thoughtful on a game like Absolver. Same thing. Like with Sandy, these tangos should be dirty and messy. On Assassin's Creed Syndicate, it was like, this is a violin concerto. Think like you would learn the Brahms concerto. You know, let's you and me in this moment are going to be Brahms and
Joachim, Joseph Joachim,
and Joachim. Yes, exactly. Like we need to be that duo in this moment, and then I'll strap on my accordion, and on something else, we're going to be, you know, like just a couple of performers on the street, you know, in front of the Hollywood Chinese Man Theater. Like, you know, busking kind of thing. So that shorthand to me, I mean, Tom Straley deserves special mention here because I've probably worked with him more than anybody else because honestly, he's on, I think, every score I write now because he's so insanely versatile. And that shorthand you're talking about is just absolutely endlessly valuable. And like I said, I mean, a perfect example of that would be that we did that movie a couple years ago called Standoff where he used the Coke bottle cap on his banjo. And I said, I've got to do more of that. And so it shows up in Absolver as a featured color. Tom and I work together so much that, no joke, he emails me like 2 months in advance what his vacation plans are because I schedule my production around that because I can't live without him, basically. And so he literally emailed me yesterday, the day before, to say, hey, I'm thinking of taking some time off with the family, like November 5th through 11th. Is that okay with you? Do we have anything going on then? Because... And you know, in that case, I was able to say, have fun, man. Go have at it. Because he knows that virtually every day there's something new together. I mean, it's really constant because he plays so many instruments. He plays them all so well. And he brings so much to the table that I can't work without him. He's such a great guy. He's a wonderful man. Any composers that are listening to this, message me on Facebook or Twitter or email me. And if you need a guitarist, I will put you in touch because Tom is so deserving of your work and just phenomenal to collaborate with and can bring an unbelievable amount and so convenient, especially for composers that are in random places in the world. You know, he can record from his home studio with tremendous results. So anyway, just a little plug for him because he's incredibly worthy of it. All these musicians are.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And then I just want one last thing I just want to touch on is the covers that you included in the Tooth and Tail soundtrack, because they are so much fun. You've got Kristen doing a cover and John Robert Matz with his crazy brass band, and Darren Korb is doing one. And so how did those all kind of get mixed in there?
Well, so that was just I was working on the album, and I was kind of panicking, frankly, because I thought, it's four scores in one. How the hell am I going to structure this? Before I realized that it made for interesting kind of meta narratives to intermingle the different factions within a given track. You know, like a big tango being suddenly interrupted by the tarantella and that kind of thing. Before I'd really figured out that that was a viable approach, I was sitting there saying, this album is going to be so boring and kind of clinical. And I remembered, and I just kind of randomly remembered on my last soundtrack with Andy, the creative director on Tooth and Tail, our last game together was called Monaco. And Monaco suffered in many respects the opposite problem of Tooth and Tail. It was so intensely cohesive. The entire score was 100% silent theater era kind of quasi-ragtime solo piano. It's as monochrome a score as I've ever written. And I thought, this album is going to be so mercilessly boring because it's like an hour of hyper-frenetic and hyper-kinetic solo piano. And it's just going to wear the ears down awfully fast. And so out of desperation to make that album more interesting, I approached about a dozen friends of mine and like YouTubers and people like that to do covers of the piano score in order to inject radically non-piano music into it. So like YouTube sensations like Maluka and Peter Hollins did versions. Tina Guo did a version. I had an 8-bit chiptune artist in the form of my very dear friend Chipsel, and a 16-bit chiptune artist who did like a almost like a SNES quasi Street Fighter type cover, and everybody just had fun. I told them, just do anything you want. The more different it is from the original, the better. And so I didn't really produce those recordings. I just told them, I did, and I gave a little bits of feedback here and there, but by and large, I just told them, go do it. Like Peter Holland's cover was like a kind of doo-wop-y barbershop sounding piece. It's just light years away from the original material. And so I remembered that I had done that previously with Andy, and I thought, maybe that can be like a thing with my collaborations with him. And I thought, it also gives me a chance to flesh out the melodies that I've written for this score, because there's so many of them, because of, you know, the factions each having their own theme and then the main theme. So I just started approaching people I thought could bring something interesting in doing renditions of those melodies. And in this case, I did pretty heavily produce the process because I did not want it to be eclectic genre-wise the way Monaco had been. I wanted it to feel like a cohesive album. And so I wanted everything to kind of live alongside the score more organically than Monaco's, in other words. And so I produced these, you know, in quite a lot of detail, actually. But I still encourage people to have fun and to stretch beyond the original score. I don't want it to be a cover in the sense of that it's like bar by bar, note for note, pretty faithful. It just needs to be stylistically faithful. The one area where I decided to allow a little bit more latitude was with Darren's, because, you know, he's like a New York rock producer, and you can hear it in his writing. And that's the thing I love so much about his writing, is that he'll do this like Southwest meets trip hop meets sort of house dance music stuff, especially in Transistor, that I think is some of the best music in game music in recent years. I mean, to me, he's absolutely one of the best composers in the business, and he's a very good friend. And so I said, I kind of want you to just sort of do your thing, because I don't want to take away from all that you can do by draining the Darren-ness out of it. But he was also interested in doing something that was cohesive to the score. You know, he was finishing up Pyre. In fact, I think he did this during the launch week of Pyre, so he was quite busy. But he still managed to fit it in, which I'm very grateful for.
And yeah, I just said, yeah, have at it. I gave him like a couple little notes when he sent me a draft, and he was very eager for feedback. But I basically was like, I want you to just kind of do your thing, man. So he did, and his was awesome. I loved it.
Yeah, they're all amazing, and they all, you know, pick up on a different quality and give a different feel to the themes. And so it's really nice to have those mixed in there, and just kind of gives you a different point of view and that kind of thing. So
that's the hope
package. It's just really neat, and you've got ambitious plans for some vinyl releases and some CDs too, right?
Yeah, I'm very fortunate to be partnering up with Vrez Sarabande on Tooth and Tail, and we'll have a CD and vinyl out for that. The artwork is just getting wrapped up now, and it's by Jerome, the artist from the actual game. You know, he did all the beautiful painted artwork that appears in the game, and I absolutely love what he did with the album covers. And then on Absolver, also CD and vinyl, in that case, a collaboration with Laced Records, based out of the UK, and the same thing. The artwork is great fun. Our mutual friend Angela Bermudez did the album art for the digital and for the CD.
And it's just beautiful.
Yeah, and she worked her ass off on it. She did so many different drafts, and she wouldn't even show me them. She'd send me a screenshot of her deleting a version where I'd see a split second of it. And then, or like a little video, you know, of it disappearing as her way to say, it's not working, I'm starting over. I mean, she really beat herself up in order to make it just perfect, and I love the result. And then the vinyl is done by an artist that that label had worked with previously. He did their Hotline Miami art. He has this hyper kind of psychedelic style. So, yeah, I always love that. I love treating the art process, the artwork, the actual cover art on an album, as its own kind of process as well. And I don't ever like to just recycle screenshots or poster images. I like to treat it like it's an album and craft an image that tells its own kind of story that lives within the world of the game or the film or whatever, but is distinct from it so that the album can stand on its own feet you know, I like albums to be albums and not just archives of the cues.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm very grateful to have all these talented people in my life. I really am. It's quite astonishing.
Yeah, well, that's just amazing. And the end result is just, you know, something that we can all enjoy, which I'm very grateful for, too. So, Austin, it's been so much fun to just really dig in and look under the hood to get, you know, kind of the inside view of both of these amazing soundtracks. And I really, really appreciate your time.
It is absolutely always a pleasure to speak with you. And we'll see you on the next one, I hope.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.